Right now, our readers at New York University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop are straining their eyes as they read your stories by flickering firelight, or maybe by backlight. But our readers are hard at work trying to choose the best of nearly 4,000 original short stories. That's how many submissions we received this round of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest here on Weekends on All Things Considered. Here are two stories that are in contention.
It was a rare week when she hadn't experienced that pungent mixture of pleasure and embarrassment. So, in the new year, under the lunchtime glare of fluorescent lights at the Afghan restaurant, she poised, ready to reel them in. Pointing to a massive skewer in the middle of the table, she cast and threw out her line.
Hey, I think I saw that used in an S&M scene once.
Her co-workers roared, putting hands over their mouths and fanning their faces as if to keep their throats from constricting around their food. They were caught. But Leanne shrugged and panned, "I'm just saying." Then she smiled, letting the edges of her mouth curl up just slightly for a moment to acknowledge their enjoyment. From left to right, she looked at each of their faces, soaking up the pleasure of having laid the right bait. But then she felt something that made her stomach sour. In a flash, she realized that they might be laughing not at her joke, but at her. She had lost her grip on the line.
I'd go out to the fields to call you in for supper and find your empty tractor idling in the emptiness. You vanished from its seat. Sometimes you'd be gone for months, other times just a matter of days. Blue and his bow tie would wave at you from a passing train, and that wild wanderer's heart would start beating fast as you'd sprint to catch up with him. Always you'd come back to a slap from Mama, a belt from Daddy, and a smile from me. You'd lift me up to take me to bed and lull me to sleep with stories of strangers you'd met and tall tales you'd been told. I'd laugh at the jokes you'd picked up at the hobo hootenannies around barrel fires and lean-to shanties. What did the little N say to the little U? You'd pause 3 beats or more until I pinched your thin-skinned shoulder for the punchline. Who knocked you over? I'd roar, and faintly you'd kiss me on my crown and promise more in the morning. I didn't want to sleep because that meant you'd be gone and I'd be alone, waiting in the dark for those monotonous cowbell clanks so I could turn over and know you were safe.
Excerpts from the stories Bait, written by Heather Matthews Hamilton, she's in San Francisco, California, and Cowbells by Danielle Dolan of Louisville, Kentucky. Our readers this week, NPR Susan Stamberg and Bob Mondello. You can find these stories and other favorites at npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. That's 3-Minute Fiction all spelled out, no spaces. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Guy Raz is away. There were anti-government demonstrations today in Morocco and news of increasing violence in Libya. We'll have the latest, but first, the number of Americans who own their own home is falling. Close to 70% of Americans owned their own homes in 2004, riding the housing bubble. Ownership was down to 66% at the end of 2010, and it is still dropping. Drastic as that sounds, it's still historically high. Our national norm is closer to 64%. Economists tell us that this is a correction, and that's our cover story today, the new reality of the housing market. Lending institutions are making it harder to buy a house, frustrating buyers across the country. Here are some of their stories.
My name is Tia Young, and I currently live in St. Louis, Missouri.
My name is Betsy Hadley, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois.
My name is Jessica Lewis, and I live in Alexandria, Virginia. We tried to buy a house last year, our first home, and we were pre-approved for a reasonable size mortgage.
And we were all set to buy our first condo. My boyfriend and I had been searching for a few months. They told us absolutely it should be no problem.
I anticipated that I would move to St. Louis and immediately jump into a new home. as when we got here, we were suddenly told by the home lenders that my credit was great, but I didn't make enough money. And my husband, his credit was mediocre, and he made great money, and we don't qualify for a home loan.
It all happened in a 48-hour period. We put a bid on the house. We won it. I think it was like a Thursday evening. We woke up Friday morning to find out that the money couldn't come. What had happened was they looked at our credit scores, which were fantastic, but they didn't go through and actually look at our history, which didn't show a debt-to-income ratio that they were comfortable with.
We had good jobs. We were making good money. We had the 20% down payment. We had good credit. Everything looked fine on paper. It was just the two-year job history with the same company or in the same field. And he basically said that we wouldn't be able to get the loan.
So now we're renting a townhome with the same square footage, except that our rent is double what I paid in a mortgage. So I'm offended. I feel like the mortgage lenders have suddenly decided that I'm a second-class citizen.
Borrowers seeking conventional mortgages, loans with no component of federal help, are finding they need better credit scores, better earnings, and one important hurdle is getting higher. Down payments that were very low in the bubble years are now headed back up. This past week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the median down payment in 9 major U.S. cities was at 22%.
And that means lots of people are moving toward rental activity rather than ownership activity.
That's Brian Westbury. He is the chief economist at First Trust Portfolios in Wheaton, Illinois. He told me,
one of the problems that people have had over time, it's always nice to literally borrow 100% of the value of the house, have it go up in value, but in reality, then you're not a homeowner. You're in a sense, you're a speculator. And so having a bigger down payment kind of shows an ability and a willingness to become a homeowner. The risks fall for everyone. Yes, it costs the homeowner more to do it this way, but they become more vested rather than just being a speculator, which is what we saw a lot of back in 2005, 2006, 2007.
Well, now, a lot of the concern as people look at these higher down payments is that lots of people will be excluded from the possibility of home ownership. Is that a good thing, a bad thing? What is that?
Well, it's probably a neutral thing in a way. Too many people were qualifying. It was too easy to qualify to get a mortgage before. And so now the reaction is probably to go a little bit overboard the other way. It's very human. It's human nature for this to happen. And the government is not helping because they've put a lot more regulations. Anyone who's tried to refinance their house or get a new mortgage today knows that you have to prove way more things about your income and where your money's come from and what your finances are than you did before. The paperwork has doubled or tripled in some cases. And I believe that over time that we will see things slide back. 20% down, it's always been traditional. I've always thought that's what my grandparents had to put down. That's what my parents had to put down. So even though the bank might want 25 or 30% from me today, I expect as an economist forecasting the future that it will eventually drift back to that 20% area.
One of the ways in which people have confronted borrowing money to buy houses in the last few years is not to look at the total debt, not to look at the down payment, but just to look at the payment as if it were rent. If they could make the payment, they could take the loan and they didn't have to think about the possibility that they owed, you know, $400,000.
And you know, when that got us in trouble back in 2003 and 2004, when the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to 1%, and that's when the real problems began in housing, I think we enticed a lot of people into the market. to do things that were a little bit further of a reach than they should have tried for because interest rates were low. And then when that went away, the game was up, so to speak, and that's when the trouble began.
That's Brian Westbury. He's chief economist at First Trust Portfolios, a financial services firm in Wheaton, Illinois, and that's where we reached him. Mr. Westbury, thank you so much.
Well, it was great to be with you today. Thank you.
So what does it mean for the USA if fully one-third of us cannot buy a home? Felix Salmon, who is a financial blogger for Reuters, suggests we look on the bright side of shrinking homeownership.
It's great that homeownership is going down because homeownership is actually bad for the economy. What homeownership does is it keeps people stuck in one place. And what you need when you have an economy with high unemployment, like we have right now, is labor mobility. We want people to be able to up and leave to where the jobs are as easily as possible. And it's very hard to do that when you own your own home and it can take months to sell it, even if you're lucky.
Do you think that that home ownership contributes to consumer spending? I mean, to a...
It did during the housing bubble, when everyone was refinancing their houses and adding wings and putting in those granite countertops and building like there was no tomorrow because house prices only went up, then that created a sort of artificial boost. And all of that money would have been put to much better use in just about any other part of the economy. Construction is the least productive part of the economy you can find. If you want to go out and make stuff and sell stuff and create things which the rest of the world wants to spend money on, that is going to be much better for the economy in the long term.
So the Census Bureau says that home ownership has gone down from the all-time high of close to 70% during the housing boom to about 66.5% now, and that's the lowest it's been in 13 years. Is 66% good or bad by your standards?
It's better than 68%. And remember, these percentages are huge. If you drop just one percentage point in an economy with 100 million households, that's a million homes we're talking about. We're talking massive numbers here. The peak was in 2004, interestingly enough. It wasn't at the very top of the housing bubble. And it's been sliding steadily ever since then. And as it continues to erode, that just increases the number of renters. And I'm quite happy with that. What I would love to see is an end to what I call the rental ghettos, these cities where you have neighborhoods which are generally the nicer neighborhoods where everybody owns, and then other neighborhoods which are much less nice neighborhoods with worse schools where everybody rents. And that makes it unpleasant to be a renter. And if you want a nicer life, you more or less have to buy your home because there's no rental housing stock in the nice neighborhoods. And what we're seeing with the housing bust is people are putting their nice houses on the market for rent for the first time. And that's a great development.
So you think that defining homeownership as wealth, as we've been doing, that goes?
I think that homeownership on a practical level, the homes are much more, they behave much more like liabilities than they do like assets. You know, the roof breaks, you've got to replace the boiler, you've got to pay insurance, you've got to pay taxes. It's, you keep on writing checks all the time. And the idea that this is some kind of an asset is kind of crazy because, A, they're very hard to sell. And B, if you do sell it, given this sort of cultural idea that you have to just buy somewhere else, you're never going to be able to turn that into cash and spend it. You're just going to have to swap it for some other house.
So are you rushing right out and buying
many houses?
Yeah, I was going to say three or four three-bedroom houses and renting them out?
Well, I would like to, but I don't have that kind of down payment, you see.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Felix Salmon, he writes a financial blog for Reuters. He joined us from our studios in New York. This month, NASA's Kepler mission announced it had found 54 planets orbiting stars in so-called habitable zones in our galaxy. Then the SETI Institute, the organization that searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, turned its radio telescopes toward those 54 planets, listening for signs of life. Nothing yet. But as reporter Brent Bachman says, intelligent life is not the only thing that makes noise in space.
This is the sound of a star. And it's true that in space no one can hear you scream, but this sound didn't travel through space as a sound. It traveled as wave energy, just like my voice is reaching your radio.
This particular one is Kepler ID 7671081.
NASA researcher John Jenkins created this recording just like your radio might, by transforming wave energy, in this case light, into sound. As part of the Kepler mission, Jenkins was measuring the light from this star to see whether there were any planets nearby.
When I started looking at these light curves, when we plot them up on the computer screen, I thought, well, what if we played one of these through a sound card and it said, "Hello, Earthlings!" Unfortunately, we haven't heard that yet, but we have heard a lot of other very interesting things.
John Jenkins says this star and the way it pulsates represents a mystery astronomers have grappled with for more than 100 years.
They understand the basic mechanism causing the pulsations. What they don't understand is they don't understand why the intensity of the pulsations changes over time.
One possible remote explanation for this? Alien life forms trying to contact us.
It would be quite awesome to think of an advanced civilization that is so advanced that it could actually modulate the brightness variations of its star. And it's not such a crazy idea. People have actually suggested in the literature that a civilization that's sufficiently advanced could actually tickle the star. So, in fact, we have some people on our science team who are actually examining stars to see whether they find evidence of this.
So you're suggesting that mysterious pulsating star could be like an alien's version of a mirror on a desert island.
That's right. They could be sending us cosmic smoke signals across the galaxy.
Would you like to swing on a star?
How do you tickle a star?
You know, I don't actually know. I think it would be quite complicated. I'm not sure if I'd want to try that. But, you know, the star might actually like it. I don't know. Would you rather be a mule?
Very few people know more about sound in space.
Hello.
Then Don Gurnett.
Yes, hi, Brent.
He's a physics professor at the University of Iowa, and he's been studying and collecting space sounds for more than 40 years.
I can remember vividly to this day when we turned the transmitter on in this spacecraft in orbit around the Earth, and we heard all these really strange sounds.
This particular sound, one of Don Gurnett's favorites, is the sound of the aurora, the Northern Lights. He's also collected the sound of lightning in Earth's upper atmosphere.
Sort of goes like that.
There's one sound in particular from Saturn's aurora. Yep, Saturn has an aurora that is so strange, you can find groups of people online who are convinced it's proof of aliens.
I know, I've heard that. I don't endorse that point of view, but nonetheless, it's pretty bizarre.
SETI director Jill Tarter says aliens would probably not sound like this. Saturn's signal is what's called an astrophysical signal, meaning it occurs naturally in space. SETI looks for a signal that doesn't.
A signal that shows up at only one channel on the radio dial, as opposed to being spread over many channels.
This is an artificial example of what the SETI Institute is listening for. That high-pitched whistle you hear is a signal that occurs on just one frequency. Nature can't produce such a sound.
Nature tends to be broadband. Technology can be broadband, but we can also produce these very narrowband artifacts that are a dead giveaway, that's some engineering there.
And engineering could mean extraterrestrial life. NASA's sharing of the Kepler discovery with SETI represented a change in the way the two agencies have worked in the past. And Jill Tarter says it could mean SETI will work more closely with NASA in the future to determine where habitable planets might be and where to turn their telescopes.
As Carl Sagan said, we are all made out of stardust. You are actually made out of the remnants of that star that blew up billions of years ago. And the connectedness of life to the cosmos and the idea of thinking about maybe life somewhere else, I think has the opportunity to trivialize the differences among humans on this planet that we find so troublesome.
Jill Tarter spoke to our producer, Brent Bachman. You can hear more space sounds on our website, npr.org.
Now, over the past few years, many out-of-work Americans have gone to a jobs office where they sign up for government-subsidized classes to learn new skills. But once they graduate, they still can't find a job. Mari Saito of WCPN in Cleveland reports on one public jobs office that shifted its focus from retraining workers to locking down open jobs.
When Larry Bender started as head of Cleveland's federally funded jobs office in mid-2008, helping people find work usually meant paying for job training.
We look at a piece of data, labor market data from the federal government, and it says you're going to need 50 advanced welders. And so you go out and train 50 people in advanced welding. And that was kind of the way it used to work. But when we started looking at our outcomes, we realized that that was delivering trained welders, but not trained employed welders.
Those workers would then brush up their resumes and pretty much hope that work appeared. Last year, Benders decided his office, Employment Connection, was approaching the problem backwards. Instead of focusing on the jobless, they needed to be zeroing in on the people doing the hiring.
We said, wait a minute, let's go and talk to the employers and say, how many welders do you need? And what sort of welders do you need? And what does a successful welder in your organization look like? Then take that information back and then try to do matches for welders in our system that fit the profile of the specific employer.
But soon after taking over the office, Bender's budget was slashed by 40%, and he had to lay off half his staff. Bender's, who had worked at companies like Ben & Jerry's and Johnson & Johnson, did hire a marketing team. They cold-called 3,000 companies to find jobs. It paid off. Over the last 6 months, Cleveland's jobs office helped nearly 1,500 people get jobs at an average wage of $11.56 an hour. The year before, it took twice the staff, twice as long, to get about the same number of people hired.
Okay, how many years of engineering-related work experience do you have?
I have 33.
55-year-old Alfred Chiazza is going over his resume with a recruiter in a Spartan office in a western Cleveland suburb. Behind him, nearly 50 out-of-work engineers in suits sit waiting their turn. The system works like this. Companies tell Employment Connection what they're looking for, recruiters screen candidates, and the best are forwarded on for more interviews and hopefully a job offer.
Can you tell me what kind of projects that was with?
Pentair. We made wastewater pumps and Moen. Moen, I've designed a number of different faucets. And
the Cleveland Jobs Office does pay for training, but only when there's a job waiting. Stephen Kowalski, CEO of a local manufacturer, hired 4 people through the agency, even though they were missing specific skills he needed.
I personally think it's a wonderful use of our tax dollars because you get tangible results. People actually get employed, which, as far as we're concerned, that should be the ultimate goal.
Now, this strategy might sound like common sense, but Cleveland is the only one of Ohio's 20 federally funded workforce areas to put placement over training. Rutgers University professor Carl Van Horn says when the federal law that authorized states to open these jobs offices passed in 1998, the economy was booming. The law aimed to help retrain workers with out-of-date skills. Fast forward to 2011, when plenty of people can't find work, even though their resumes are impressive.
The challenge in this economy is very different than it was when this law was passed. So there is a bit of a mismatch between the policy structure that we have at the federal level and the realities of the economy that we face today.
Van Horn and others say many of the country's nearly 600 federally funded workforce areas emphasize training, but no one really knows how unusual Cleveland's strategy is. Chris King, a University of Texas labor economist, says focusing on hiring is smart but difficult.
If you make a really good match between a progressive employer that's going to help train those people once they get on the job, that's going to have much better results. If you simply make a match in a firm that's busy turning people over right and left, that's really not going to do much for anybody.
Cleveland's Employment Connection is set to double the number of people it helps get jobs this year. And they'll do that not by just offering them retraining, but by finding jobs for the workers that come to them for help. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
This past week, machine defeated man handily. The IBM supercomputer known as Watson humbled its human opponents on the TV game show Jeopardy. Watson was developed to analyze natural language, even humor and riddles.
Now the last clue. Even a broken one of these on your wall is right twice a day. Watson.
What is clock?
Clock is correct. And with that, you move up to 23,000.
You think your job could not be done by a computer? Think again. Or artificial intelligence may do the thinking for you. Martin Ford has written a three-part series for The Atlantic about the future of AI, artificial intelligence. And he joins me from Stanford, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
We typically associate low skill or low wage or mechanical jobs with the move to automation. You're writing about high-paying jobs, though. You're writing about jobs that require graduate degrees. That could be done by machines. An example you give is radiology.
That's right. Radiologists basically focus on looking at visual images from medical devices, things like x-rays or CAT scans, that type of thing, and then analyzing those, interpreting the results, and making a diagnosis. Now, machines are getting much better at analyzing that types of visual information. For example, in airports, we've got systems that allow systems to look at photos and compare those to a database of terrorists. Analyzing all that kind of dynamic information and making a comparison is actually technically very difficult. It may actually be much easier for a computer to look at a very standardized medical image and apply standardized analysis to it and automate a lot of that job.
You suggest that even a lawyer's job could be done by a computer, at least in part. And now surely that is the kind of, you know, sort of creative, fast on your feet, intuitive, instinctive, the kind of things that computers are not supposed to be so good at.
Well, there are a lot of lawyers that never go into courtrooms. I mean, there are lawyers that are engaged in legal research. They work with contracts. It's all paperwork. A lot of that is not really too different than what someone like Watson is doing or even what search engines are doing. It's about finding, summarizing information. So a lot of that is certainly subject to automation going down the line.
Now, are we turning into our own worst enemy here? I mean, we have created efficiencies, that is to say, we've created jobs that can easily be done from the comfort of a computer screen. And then, of course, the masters of that particular universe have said, fine, the computer screen could be anywhere. It could be somewhere where people don't earn that much money per hour. And now you are suggesting that the next step is to move it back from the third world country and into a computer, that artificial intelligence can do that kind of job.
Right. I think that in many cases what you'll see is the offshoring type practice that's going on now that many people are concerned about is kind of the leading edge of automation. They're both similar types of things. You know, they both are highly dependent on technology, on communications technology. Eventually, a lot of the stuff that's being offshored will be automated, I think.
So, I mean, are we a generation away from radiologists being extinct? Are we? Is this going to happen in the middle of next week? I mean, what does the future look like?
It's hard to pin down. I don't think it's going to happen next week. If I had to guess, I would say that within the next 10 years, we're going to see some fairly definite increasing evidence of this. But it's very hard to say exactly when. One thing we can say, though, is that things are moving at a faster and faster rate. You know, technology, in particular information technology, is accelerating. And it's gonna have a very big impact at some point, a disruptive impact, I think.
Martin Ford's three-part series about the future of artificial intelligence appears in The Atlantic. You can see it at atlantic.com. It's adapted from his book, The Lights in the Tunnel: Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future. Mr. Ford, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.